Hi, I'm Kathy Moranti, and this is Inspiration for Life Guideposts, June-July 2024. Generation to generation, some of your favorite guidepost writers share what they learned from their fathers. I love you, Dad. Life is an Adventure, written by Daniel Shantz, Moberly, Missouri. The hardest thing about being a pastor's kid was moving all the time, 7 times in 10 years. I hated it. I even threatened to run away when I was 13. Think of it as an adventure, Dad said. The good Lord always provides. Those words grated on me, but I couldn't help noticing how much Dad lived them out. He was a genuine, upbeat person, always whistling favorite hymns and savoring the little things in life, enjoying a good breakfast, reading the morning paper, walking to the post office, tending his garden, helping Mom in the kitchen. Life was an adventure because Dad trusted God, and God makes even little things extraordinary. What Love Looks Like, written by Carolyn Conklin, Seattle, Washington. My father collected Chinese vases. Once I persuaded him to let me take 2 of the prettiest ones to school for show and tell. A classmate accidentally picked up the box and dropped it. The vases broke into pieces. I knew this was a bad idea, Dad said, jaw clenched. I waited for the punishment, but he collected himself and said, "These things happen. It wasn't your fault." Still, I ended up crying myself to sleep that night. The next morning, the 2 vases were standing on the kitchen table. Had it all been a bad dream? No. Dad knew how awful I felt and stayed up late repairing the vases. It was his way of saying, "I love you." A Gentle Soul, Shawnell Eliason, LeClaire, Iowa. My daddy worked in a steel mill. He carried a metal lunchbox. His work clothes smelled of machines and hard labor. He was a sacrificial provider. Only when I was a parent myself did I learn he was so much more than that. I marveled at how tenderly Daddy held my babies. He taught my 2-year-old to sing Southern gospel while he played his harmonica. He explained to my sons how, in springtime, the Lord brings forth 100 shades of green. When they were teenagers, he held his own conversations about John Steinbeck and F. Scott Fitzgerald. Who was this gentle, musical, literary man? I've been too wrapped up in myself to notice when I was young. Now I know that God, too, is a generous provider. His gifts are in everyone. You just have to look. Do Unto Others, written by Robin Diaz, Scottsville, Arizona. My dad worked as a high-level job recruiter in New York. Every day he interviewed executives for positions with prestigious corporations. Dad asked them about their qualifications. Then he added a qualification of his own. He took them out to lunch and observed how they treated others, the cab driver, the coat check person, and especially the wait staff. "Why, Dad?" I asked him once. "The golden rule," he answered, "do unto others as you would have them do unto you." How someone interacts with people of less status reveals their true character. My dad came from poverty in Ohio coal country. He was the first in his family to graduate college and went on to earn a PhD in economics. He respected the careers of people he interviewed, but if they were not kind and caring to those serving them, my father took note. I have never forgotten Dad's quiet lesson of seeing people through God's eyes. You Can Do It, Jenny Ivy, Cookeville, Tennessee. Daddy taught me to ride a bike when I turned 5. With one hand on the handlebars and the other holding the bike steady, he guided me down our concrete driveway. "Whatever you do, keep on pedaling," Daddy said. "Don't worry, I'm right here beside you. You can do it." I fell so many times, but Daddy was true to his word. He was always there to pick me up and get me back on the bike. They say kids learn about God by watching their parents. I still remember that day on the bike. I still picture God saying, "Don't worry, I'm right here beside you. You can do it." The Gift of Time, written by Peggy Eastman, Chevy Chase, Maryland. In his final years, health problems kept my father homebound. I visited often. I brought cornbread, his favorite, but what he really loved was company. We talked about everything, including whether life existed on other planets. Dad was well-read and well-informed. I couldn't fix Dad's health, but I could give him something he prized just as much, my time. It's one of the most valuable gifts you can give someone. Whatever You Set Your Mind To, written by Marilyn Turk, Niceville, Florida. My daddy taught my siblings and me to water ski. He took us out on the lake and towed us around until we got it. It was a true gift of love. My daddy had never skied. After contracting polio as a child, he had trouble walking, let alone skiing. I never thought of him as disabled. He could swim side stroke, and he kept himself busy with work and gardening. He was a big fan of Norman Vincent Peale. You can do whatever you set your mind to, my daddy told me. I believe it, because I saw him do it. Girl Dad, written by Gloria Joyce, Willow Grove, Pennsylvania. My dad was a railroad engineer who longed for sons. He got me. Our relationship wasn't easy, but there was one place where we bonded. Dad's workbench. He was always building or fixing something. Just because I was a girl didn't mean I couldn't help him. I beamed when he said, "That girl sure knows her way around a hammer." I married a man who couldn't hammer a nail to save his life. Dad taught him, then our daughters, Anna and Cassidy. When my girls proudly displayed their latest home improvement project, I feel Dad's love. Live to the Max, written by Christy Dewberry, Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. When my father was diagnosed with terminal pancreatic cancer, everyone in the family was dismayed, except for Dad. "If I have 6 months to live, I'm going to make them the best months of my life," he declared. And between treatments, he did. He and Mom went on a cruise. They rode the train from Oklahoma City to Fort Worth. He hosted Oklahoma State football watch parties, took a beach vacation to Florida. Before we knew it, he'd blown past that six-month expiration date. He took daily walks, spent lazy afternoons reading. He loved John Grisham. At his lakeside cabin, his oncologist called him Superman. He inspired other patients. Dad lived five fulfilling years after his diagnosis. I was holding his hand when he died. "If you feel like God is calling you home, it's okay to go," I said. Dad lived life to the max. I try to do the same. The World is a Teacher, written by Roberta Messner, Huntington, West Virginia. One by one, my father's older siblings left the family farm for college and went into education. My father yearned to follow. He loved books and learning. As a child, he read Longfellow and Shakespeare. The youngest of 10, he was forced to take over the farm when his parents died. Daddy became a scholar anyway. He memorized poems and recited them during chores. He studied food labels to learn scientific terms. He bought a Webster's dictionary and read it every night. He became an expert asker of questions. Everyone he met, he quizzed about their jobs, their hobbies, their families. "The world is a teacher, Roberta," he told me. "You just have to ask the right questions." I still live by Daddy's words. The world is my teacher, too. I hope I become as learned as he was. One Right Thing, written by Diane Stark, Brazil, Indiana. My parents didn't get along, and Dad's response, or was it the cause, was to be a workaholic. He seemed to take little interest in my life. Eventually, he and Mom divorced. My relationship with him is still awkward. Recently, I realized Dad had done one major thing right. He'd made sure my siblings and I went to church. I raised my own kids in the church, and it remains a foundation of my life. My 15-year-old son recently announced he wants to become a pastor. A father doesn't have to be perfect to have a positive influence. One right thing can do the world a good. Actions Can Speak Louder, written by Lou Dean, Dinosaur, Colorado. My mama walked out on our family when I was a little girl. Dad raised four children, worked full-time for the railroad, and maintained a 160-acre farm on the Oklahoma prairie by himself. He rarely showed emotion, never told my siblings and me he loved us. Even as adults, we longed for a hug or an affectionate word. One summer afternoon, years after I had left home, I sat with Dad, watching his cattle graze in the distance. "How come you've never been able to show us kids any affection?" I asked bluntly. Dad flicked ash from his cigarette and said nothing. This was his usual response when asked a difficult question. Silence. At last he said, "Your mama was big on saying she loved us. I tried to show I cared by taking care of you." Suddenly, I saw life through his eyes, how deeply Mama had hurt him, how hard those years as a single parent must have been. At the end of my visit, I gave Dad a lingering hug. For the first time in 34 years, he reciprocated with a brief squeeze. Dad died in an accident before I could see him again. Four decades later, the memory of that one hug remains a blessing, as does Dad's reminder that love is no less strong for being unspoken. Miracles and Healing, I Heard You Praying. As a hospital chaplain, I had seen hopeless cases, but never one more seemingly hopeless than this. Written by Adam Ruse, Louisville, Kentucky. I was a chaplain on duty that Friday night. I leaned over the nurse's station on the surgical intensive care unit to get briefed on the patient awaiting me in room one. The paramedics brought her in earlier today with a gunshot wound to the head, the nurse said. She's out of surgery. Her parents are here and asked for a chaplain. She's in an induced coma. She's not going to live. And if by some miracle she does... Her voice trailed off, but after 3 years working at Louisville's only level one trauma center, I'd seen my share of gunshot victims and knew the tragedy that was unfolding. What comfort could I offer this family? I headed to room one, my steps slow and deliberate. Part of my training was that it was okay not to rush into these situations, to be intentional and seek God's guidance. Sometimes I still wondered whether I was cut out to be a hospital chaplain, whether I was really helping people when my work left me with spiritual questions of my own. A professor at seminary has suggested this path because of my experience with a life-threatening illness. I had a brain tumor as a teenager and insistently prayed for immediate healing. Instead, I suffered deafness and severe balance issues. Eventually, the tumor was successfully removed, but my other afflictions remained for years. My prayers changed from demanding a miracle to surrendering to God's plan for me. It was then that I was able to live a full life again, a miracle I hadn't expected. I entered seminary, wanting to give others the hope I found. That was what I tried to bring to the patients and families I met with, hope, not for a miracle healing, but that they feel God's presence, whatever the outcome. I walked into room one. The young woman lay eerily still, her head wrapped in bandages, her face swollen, tubes and wires crisscrossing her body. The only sounds were beeps and sighs of the machines keeping her alive. I introduced myself to her parents. "I can't imagine what you must be feeling," I said. The mother held her daughter's hand. The father glanced at me. I rested my hand on his shoulder. He pressed his hand into my shoulder, and I held him. "Thank you for coming," he said at last. "Why did this happen? I don't understand." His wife looked up. As I always do, I asked about their faith practice. They told me they were Catholic, as am I. "Will you pray?" the mother asked. "Certainly," I said, then paused. The parents were surely praying for a miracle, and I wanted to do the same, but I couldn't bring myself to say the words. I didn't want them clinging to false hope. "Jesus, I thank you that you're here with us now," I prayed. "I know you love us, and knowing this gives me the confidence to ask for your help. You see the need. You know what's on our hearts. I trust our little faith will be enough. Thank you for listening." The parents joined me in saying the Lord's Prayer and the Hail Mary. "Amen," we said in unison. I looked to the young woman. I did a double take. Her eyes were open. She saw her parents and began to weep. How was this possible? Her parents, astonished, reached over the bed rails to hold her. I backed away, wanting to give them privacy. After a few minutes, the father came to me. "We are so grateful," he said. "God is good," I offered, still stunned. "Stay strong. I'll try to check in later." I circled back to the nurse who'd briefed me earlier. "The patient just opened her eyes," I said. "She seemed conscious." "It was just a momentary rebound," she said. "She wouldn't come out of a coma that quickly." I returned to the chaplain's office, trying to reconcile what the nurse had said with what I'd seen. She noted earlier that if the patient lived, there would be significant issues, possibly catastrophic disabilities. I thought again of my prayer. What if my words and their daughter's inexplicable yet temporary response only ended up adding to the parents' grief? My pager buzzed. The emergency department, a car accident. Come immediately. The next crisis was at hand. It would last long into the night. I was off work the next 3 days. Back on duty on Tuesday, I was called to visit a patient. On the 8th floor, I passed a room with the door open. "Chaplain," a voice called. I poked my head inside. A woman dressed all in white sat in a recliner. Her gown seemed to glow, almost the way the Bible describes angels' robes. "Good evening," I said. "I'm Chaplain Adam." The woman smiled. "You don't recognize me, do you?" I took a mental inventory of the patients I'd seen. "No, I don't. I'm the one shot in the head. The one you prayed for in the ICU. Impossible." "Of course I remember you," I said, although she bore little resemblance to the patient who'd been lying in the bed motionless on life support. "How are you?" Much better, she said with a gentle laugh. I don't remember much, but I remember a man's voice introducing himself and saying he was going to pray. My parents later told me about you. I heard your prayers, at first coming from far away, and then closer and closer, then crystal clear. I heard you say amen, and my eyes opened, and I saw my parents. I was dumbfounded. My mind flooded with questions. Why aren't you still in the ICU? I don't know, she said. I got better and they put me on this floor today. I haven't needed any pain medication or anything. The doctors say I'm a miracle. I couldn't process any of this. But weren't you shot in the head? Weren't you in a coma? Her smile grew wider. He prayed and I was brought back somehow. That's all I know. My pager buzzed. Another major car accident. Multiple injuries. I have to go, I said. I'll be back. The calls never lit up that night. By the time I was able to return to the woman's room the next day, she'd been discharged. I was left with a mystery. I work side by side with people who are experts in medicine and how the human body works and what its limits are in both the spiritual and physical realms. There was much that couldn't be explained. But I needed answers. My questions went to the very heart of my role as a chaplain. What did it mean to pray for someone? Once the words are said, what actually happens? My prayer over the patient in room one had been nothing special. What role, if any, had it played in the miracle that followed? Why was this woman healed when so many others I'd prayed for weren't? It couldn't be that God favored one person over another, or that he was present for this situation but absent on other occasions. A loving God would not stand by and watch while people suffer. Day after day, these thoughts and questions weighed on me. One day, after my morning prayers, feeling the quiet of the moment, I was able to still my mind. I pictured the young woman again, replayed the conversation we'd had. What I saw now was the joy that radiated from her being. She wasn't beset with questions about the nature of prayer or miracles. She was celebrating the gift she'd been given without trying to understand it fully. Isn't a miracle by definition beyond our comprehension? I'd been brought to her bedside and the bedside of every patient I minister to for a reason. I might not completely understand the reason in each instance, but I could accept that now. It was enough to know that God is at my side. He has chosen me to be a messenger of hope, which is never false. Close calls, God's pillow. In 2016, the Sabine's fire in Northern California was the costliest ever in the United States. It almost cost me my life, despite the promise I made to my wife. Written by John Tiersma, Dunsmuir, California. On the worst and best day of my life, I was behind the wheel of a 2,300-gallon water tanker truck heading straight toward the flames of a raging California wildfire. It was September 11, 2016. The Sabine's fire was on its way to burning 132,127 acres of rugged mountain wilderness east of the Big Sur coastline. Started by an illegal campfire, the blaze would go on to kill one firefighter, destroy 57 homes, and cost more than $260 million to suppress. I had been hired by a private contractor to deliver water to government firefighters on the backcountry fire line. The work was incredibly dangerous. I led a small caravan of two tanker trucks along a narrow, treacherous ridgetop fire road. One false move and my truck, carrying some 18,000 pounds of water, would plunge hundreds of feet to the bottom of a ravine. I live for moments like this. I'd been an adventure seeker all of my life. The riskier, the better. Helping fight wildfires was a dream job. I tried to put out of my mind the fact that this job was also causing major problems in my marriage. My wife, Cassandra, didn't even know I was here. She thought I was at the firefighters' base camp. She'd made me a promise not to sign up for backcountry duty. I promise, I said on my way out the door. A promise I promptly broke when I arrived at the base camp and learned they urgently needed drivers to supply a remote team of firefighters. I couldn't resist. I made all the usual excuses. Driving a water truck was way less dangerous than actually fighting the fire. The team needed me. I had to earn a living somehow. Cassandra just didn't understand what work like this meant to me. I hated anything resembling desk work. I'd even quit a job as a freight train conductor after discovering it mostly involved filling out forms. If Cassandra truly understood how I felt, I wouldn't have to deceive her. I was grateful the road demanded all my attention. Guilt weighed on me despite all of my excuses. I drove slowly, easing around rocks and erosion. To one side, the Pacific Ocean glittered. To the other, a wall of smoke hung over 5,000-foot peaks. I glanced in my rearview mirror to make sure the tanker truck behind me was keeping up. Suddenly, I felt a lurch. My truck began to tip. An eroded part of the road had given way under my left front tire. My truck was going over the edge. I swerved right, but it was too late. The water in my tank sloshed left, and the weight of all that liquid plunged the truck off the road. Before I knew it, I was barrel rolling down the ravine. The world spun, and the truck groaned. Dirt and gravel flew in the windows. Objects I stored on the seat beside me, tools, pieces of metal water pump, crashed around the cab. I'm going to die, I thought. God, get me out of here, I begged. The truck shook and roared. I felt a violent movement. Suddenly, I was lying on the scree above the ravine. I watched the truck continue to flip and roll below me. With a sickening crash, it slammed into the bottom of the ravine and burst apart. I tried to move, but my body exploded with pain. I felt something prickly and realized I had landed in a bed of Mazantia bushes. How did I get here? Somehow, my seat belt had come loose, and I'd been ejected from the truck and caught by this bush. If I hadn't been in shock, I would have cried tears of gratitude. John, a voice called from above. A silhouetted figure peered over the ridge top. It was the other truck driver. Are you there? She shouted. I'm here, I said weakly. Stay there, another voice commanded. A firefighter had been riding shotgun in the other truck. He began calling my name repeatedly, picking his way down the ravine toward me as I responded. At last he reached me. Don't move, he said, as if I could. He radioed for a helicopter and checked my vital signs. I heard other firefighters climbing down. Help was arriving fast. Whoop, whoop. The helicopter appeared overhead. The slope was too steep for the chopper to land, so the firefighters strapped me onto a rescue seat. I felt myself rise out of the Mazantia. Moments later, I was in the helicopter, speeding over the mountains toward a trauma center in Salinas. The next day, I lay in a hospital bed. Beside me sat Cassandra. She jumped in her car and raced 300 miles from our home near Mount Shasta the minute she got the call from the fire agency. She had already kissed me and told me how relieved she was that I was alive. Now came her justified wrath. You lied to me, she said in disbelief. You promised, and you flat out lied. Why? I didn't have an answer. The cost of my dishonesty was obvious. I had 3 broken ribs, a ruptured spleen, staples in my head, gouges in one hand, a broken collarbone, and a wrenched shoulder. My labored breathing made even apologizing difficult. What could I say to Cassandra anyway? God's goodness became more apparent when firefighters visited and told me just how miraculous my survival had been. One of the paramedics called the Mazantia bush that caught me God's pillow. There was nothing left of the truck but the frame, the radiator, and bits of the water tank. Everything else was demolished, just as I would have been without God's pillow. Why had God saved me? I had done nothing to deserve his help. I was officially disabled for a year. It took months of physical therapy to walk, move, and breathe normally again. PTSD made me reluctant to drive. Maybe that was a good thing. Cassandra would have flipped out if I'd tried to go back to working at wildfires. You broke your promise, she kept saying to me. How can I trust you again? All my attempts at explanation failed. I'd messed up big time. Words felt insignificant. My long convalescence gave me plenty of time to ponder. Fighting wildfires was by no means the first time I'd risked my life and my family for work. Cassandra and I had met after both of our first marriages fell apart. I'd raised kids with my first wife and always struggled to balance family with my need for adventure. Many of my jobs I'd done over the years, long-distance truck driving, traveling, mill work, took me away from home for extended periods. Others were downright dangerous. I had met Cassandra at a Christian singles potluck in Washington. I worked one of my all-time favorite jobs then, servicing grain elevators. I routinely climbed atop 100-foot-tall structures, seldom wearing a safety harness. I loved feeling on top of the world. A fall could have been fatal. After we moved to California, I tried the railroad, then stumbled into delivering water. You wouldn't think water delivery was dangerous, but marijuana had become legal in California, and drug cartels had arrived in our part of the state. Most of my farmer customers paid in cash. It was a prime target for cartel thieves. Worried, Cassandra urged me to look for a different job. She was dubious that I could earn good money working for firefighters. "Sounds dangerous," she said. That's when I promised not to sign up for risky duty. I'd kept that promise during the first couple fires I worked. Then came the Sabrines fire. Why did I keep putting my life, as well as my family, at risk? Lord, what is wrong with me? What will it take for me to change? When I recovered enough to begin looking for part-time light-duty work, I found an opening for a local pharmacy delivery driver. Cassandra gave the job an instant thumbs up. "You drive a car," she said approvingly. "Sounds very safe." The old me would have laughed at such a job. Now I was so humbled and rattled by the accident, and I secretly rejoiced at the prospect of non-strenuous, risk-free work. The elderly lady at my first delivery seemed delighted to see me. "You're the first person I've talked to all day," she said. "I wish I could get someone out here to fix my sink that quick." "I can fix a sink," I said. 20 minutes later, with the lady's sink fixed, I walked back to my car feeling a strange sense of satisfaction. The feeling grew as the day went on. Not all customers needed something repaired, but they were all glad to see me. I talked to each one, getting to know them. House after house, my sense of satisfaction grew. I drove home looking forward to making more deliveries and helping people the next day. My enjoyment in the job deepened. I became friends with just about everyone on my route. I helped them around the house, checked in on their lives, brightened their day. Why on earth did I like this job so much? Sure, it was safe, but everything else about it was the opposite of what I'd always craved. There was no thrill, no excitement. No, this job had something better, something I didn't even know I'd been looking for all my life. A sense of purpose and the satisfaction of knowing I mattered to folks. At last, I knew what I needed to say to Cassandra. "I'm sorry," I said one day after work. "I betrayed your trust. I hope you can forgive me. God has been showing me some things about myself. You don't have to worry about me risking my life anymore. I've got more important things to do." After a year making deliveries, I took a better-paying job driving a school bus. I loved that job even more. It was like work and family rolled into one. I recently retired. Cassandra and I are converting a 40-foot school bus into an RV tour the country. I let God take the wheel of my life, and He steered me out of danger and toward so much more. He showed me that helping others and being there for my family are as valuable as putting my life on the line. The real danger, I realized, is missing out on God's life-giving purpose. After all these years, I'm so glad I found mine. The Upside, quotes from today's positive thinkers. When we help other people, we establish an experience or a connection with them, but we also remind ourselves of the value that we bring to the world. Written by Dr. Vivek Murphy, U.S. Surgeon General, on how to combat the public health epidemic of loneliness in this country. The people who make a difference are not the ones with the credentials, but the ones with the concern. Max Lucado, Pastor. You cannot forgive without grace, and grace is not something you can demand. You can only sweep out the chamber of your soul and be ready to receive it when it comes. Murabi Starr, author. The point of life is connection with God, with our own hearts, and with the people God puts in our distinctive corner of the world. From Entangle Your Emotions, Naming What You Feel and Knowing What to Do About It, by Jenny Allen. Happiness is not having the best of everything, but the ability to make the best of anything. Brianna West, author. Joy, it is a journey, but you know it's something that you have to consciously do. Make yourself happy. In the midst of all of it, remain hopeful. Never give up. Ruby Bridges, civil rights activist. God has a plan in the storms of life, but we don't always know what it is. That's the part that requires faith. We reach for a plan, but Jesus offers His hand instead of a map. Bonnie Gray, writer. That's all we have time for today. I've been reading Inspiration for Life Guideposts, June-July 2024. I'm Kathy Maranti. Thanks for listening to Chris.